Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast.
I'm Dude. I got Andy and Don with me. It's Halloween time, and I hope I didn't scare the guys away with that terrible Dracula. Y'all still here? How you doing?
It's kind of a sensual Dracula. I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Hello, Mr. Darkness.
Yes, I'm definitely the lover version of Dracula.
Of course.
I don't want to kill anyone. Just want to drink enough blood to get by and maybe find some romance along the way.
Well, that's very sweet of you. How are you doing over there, Don?
Here's Donnie!
Not bad.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
All right, so this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums, the album format, and finding excuses to talk about them. We've got a great show for you today. We're each picking an album to discuss that has some kind of Halloween connotations to it, some creepiness, some spookiness. Don's going to ask us a deep question. Then we're going to have some shout-outs to some other albums and album-related items that we're digging. And then we'll spin that wheel of musical discovery to find out what we're going to talk about next time. But this week, it's all about Halloween.
That's what I'm talking about!
Halloween's musical landscape is as diverse and enchanting as the holiday itself, from the mournful Celtic tunes of old to the jazz-infused melodies of the early 20th century, the rock and roll-inspired hits of the 50s and 60s, to the eerie synthesizer-driven soundtracks of horror films. The music of Halloween has evolved to capture the essence of this spooky season. These tunes not only set the mood, but also play a crucial role in bringing the spirit of Halloween to life. Today, each of us will present an album that feels like Halloween.
Jeez.
I should have done that in the Crypt Keeper voice or something.
Halloween!
It would have been funny for a couple of seconds.
Until my voice
gave out. Then it would have gotten weird. Then your voice would have given out and it would have gotten entertaining again. Yeah, so this is, it's tougher than it seems, right? When you're trying to find a whole album that isn't the Monster Mash.
Right.
And then there's only so many that exist. So digging around trying to find some stuff that brings that creepy feeling.
It's also good.
Yes, it's also good. Because there are plenty of records where it's scary stuff, but it's not good. So yeah, well, how'd you guys do? What other stuff did you consider this week?
Well, I'll mention it's probably become one of the more popular modern day Halloween records that I do come back to this time of year. Rob Zombie's Hellbilly Deluxe from 1998. Mm. I enjoyed that when it came out. It still sounds pretty fun. He's really he's a big old horror movie buff, and it shows on that album, and I kind of love that.
I've never made it through the whole thing.
Really? It's like 45 minutes.
It's about 40 minutes too much.
Not a big zombie fan.
I'll give it another try.
I just found out he worked on Pee-wee's Playhouse. He was like the crew.
Oh, on the show?
Yes. No, he didn't actually build the playhouse.
I never know.
He's a pretty diverse guy. The other one I'll mention too, I think I may have talked about on the show many moons ago. It's from a experimental ambient group from the UK by the name of Coil. They have a bunch of albums that are suitable for Halloween, but the one I always come back to this time of year is Music to Play in the Dark, Volume 1 is excellent. They also have a record called Astral Disaster from the same year, 1999. That is also very creepy.
I do remember Music to Play in the Dark. I think we talked about that once.
Yes.
It was more disturbing somehow than creepy, but it didn't have any vocals, right? I mean,
yeah, it's just instrumental and little recorded passages, and it's strange. I love it.
It made me uneasy.
That's the idea. How about you, Don?
Well, this time of year, I like to immerse myself in the darker side of The Cure, and probably the best example of that is their album Pornography from 1982. Which we covered on episode 137. But they're, you know, sometimes they're labeled as a goth group, and that album is definitely dark and it deals with death and stuff, but it doesn't do like the vampire crap and the, you know, it's all like real stuff. It's not imaginary. Yeah. So it's, you know, even darker in that way. And then, you know, I just wanted to mention kind of the original Halloween song, you know, the Monster Mash. So there actually is, I didn't realize there was an entire album of this stuff. So it's Bobby, Boris Pickett, and the Crypt Keepers. And the album's called The Original Monster Mash from 1962.
Crypt Kickers.
Oh, did I? Sorry. Yes.
I hate that.
But yeah, it's just like every song is some monster based version of like a 1950s or 60s rock and roll tune. It's amusing. And you know, if you had a Halloween party, you know, it'd be kind of cool to have on.
Yeah. Not a great, just a dedicated listening experience though.
Not really.
One of the albums that I considered is actually not too far from that same theme as Bobby Boris Pickett and the Crypt Kickers. It was Iced Earth, their album Horror Show. It's a concept album that brings classic horror figures like Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, Damien, and it's kind of traditional heavy metal with some thrash elements, but each song is about that monster. Intricate solos, dramatic vocals, it's haunting, it's fun, but ultimately it wasn't very spooky. It was just it was great thrash music with a, you know, song happened to be about Frankenstein. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So,
but it was definitely an enjoyable listen. And then every time we talk about Halloween and picking a record, I once again take a swing at Alice Cooper's Welcome to My Nightmare from 1975. I can't do it, man. It's produced by Bob Ezrin. He did Kiss Destroyer and The Elder. It's very theatrical, but it's very uneven. It shifts into pop and disco moments. And it showcases Cooper's dark storytelling, but the thread that's supposed to be that this is the story of the series of nightmares a kid is having, I can't follow it, so I get bored. I want to like it.
Yeah, some of those concepts, just get a little too full of themselves.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of the stuff just ends up coming off as corny. Whereas like a Metallica album actually is scary and it's not corny, you know.
Right. Before they sold out.
Right.
Right, Andy?
Right. Yeah. Thank you for adding that in before I could.
All right. Well, why don't we get into the spooky albums that we did pick?
You choose me?
All right, for my Halloween selection, we are talking about The Cramps and their 1980 album, Songs the Lord Taught Us.
Sounds like it's going to be delightful and help me learn about the Lord.
Yes, yes, and keep your muscles in good shape. Okay, so The Cramps are a four-piece from New York City. They're comprised primarily of a husband and wife duo. You guys ready for their names? Lux Interior on vocals and Poison Ivy Rorschach on guitar.
Mm, those are like Western European names, yeah?
yeah, exactly. I think they're French.
Ah.
Yeah. All right, let's jump in here and play I Was a Teenage Werewolf. You guys ever seen the film I Was a Teenage Werewolf from 1957?
Yes.
With Paw from Little House on the Prairie?
Yes, I think so. Michael Landon, is that his name?
Yeah, yep. I saw it as a kid, back when they used to play a lot of those old black and white horror movies in October.
Yeah, well, that's one of them, and that's the song about it, apparently. So, The Cramps here, this is a pretty interesting record. I've come across this maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Just love the sort of deranged sound they have. They're known for kind of founding this genre of psychobilly, is what it's called, which is kind of a combination of like rockabilly and punk rock. They came from California, moved over to New York City, and got involved with that New York City punk rock scene in the late 70s and early 80s. Kind of the CBGBs and those groups who were playing there. Suicide, the Ramones, Patti Smith, Television, etc. And they were pretty popular back in the day in that scene. My clickbait headline for Songs the Lord Taught Us is, "Be sure to stretch before surfing with these psychobillies."
What's with the muscles and the stretching with you in this album?
You got the cramps, man. These guys are not properly hydrated.
Well, eat a banana, right?
Well, yeah.
Potassium.
I'll do it. Okay.
Are they swimming too soon after eating?
Well, yeah. I didn't want to make it too complicated, but that could be a contributing factor, yes. I think what they do best is kind of add that darkness to that sort of surf rock sound. Frontman Lux there has a real sort of unsettling delivery, I would say. He goes from kind of like a lounge singer, almost like a Elvis impersonator vibe at times, to like a sort of like a punk rock scream, which I think is pretty effective when he does it like that.
But there are those B-52s moments, mm-hmm. though, too, where he is like this, and it's like, what's happening?
Yeah, right? The pace is all over the place. Sometimes it's very upbeat. Sometimes it's more slowed down and dark. But I would say the whole thing is kind of unhinged. And we play a cut here towards the end of the record. This is a cover by Johnny Brunette and the Rock and Roll Trio. It's called Tear It Up.
Yeah, well, what better way to demonstrate your psychobilly style than by covering a rockabilly classic? So, yeah, you know, just kind of a standard bluesy rockabilly riff, but, you know, with that punk rock spirit, pretty effective, I think. And that's one of two covers on the album, I believe, the other being Fever.
Strychnine as well.
Never mind.
Yeah, I like the Fever. It makes it not sexy, which is kind of cool. Instead, it's like stalkery. You give me fever, and you know, like it feels like they're excited by this person, but maybe the person isn't excited back. I kind of like that twist on it.
Right, well, my headline for the Cramps: Trash in the Cramps Garage leaves sweet psychobilly stench. I don't know. I wanted to incorporate the word garage and sort of that it's like trashy music.
Yeah.
Right.
That smells. Yeah.
Yeah. But in a good way, you know, so it is kind of a charming record for some reason. I mean, I guess because it's different, right? Different from the other punk rock that was out there.
Well, you know, surf rock and that whole surf guitar style was dead. That was so dated. It was so early, mid 60s. Mm-hmm. And that had become so cliche and sort of taking it and then this obsession with it and then bringing that guitar sound into this punk era was very interesting because it was like an ugly version of it, which was really cool. So that's the ultimate way to be a punk is to take something that was something and then crumple it up and spit on it, you know, which and it sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like such a New York City thing to me. Like, they took this sound from the West Coast and just made it, like, ugly and gnarly and threw some trash on it.
Awesome. Yeah.
And it does, I mean, it approaches corniness, you know, by having some of the horror themes. But in a way, it really works with punk rock because, you know, a lot of things, you know, a lot of these horror monsters like werewolves, I think they're meant to sort of symbolize sort of the wild spirit of a human being. Mm. And of course, that's what punk rock is, right? It's that sort of wild side of us. So it...
They're the monsters.
Yeah, so it kind of works. So, the album is produced by Alex Chilton from the Box Tops. This album, it's very raw, the production. I contrasted it with, Nevermind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols. Because I remember that album, despite it, you know, having that punk edge, it was really cleanly produced. It was... kind of polished sounding. You could hear all the instruments. This one is just even more chaotic and really does kind of sound like you're listening to a band playing in their garage.
Yeah. It has a bit of a live show feel to it, I would say. It feels like unexpected things could happen as you're listening to the record.
Yeah. And then the other interesting thing about it is that, I don't think there's any bass guitar on the album.
Yeah. I was surprised by that too. They apparently didn't have a bass until like the mid 80s. Which is surprising.
I'll have to listen again. I guess I didn't notice that there wasn't bass. Makes sense, though, now that I think about it.
There's two guitars, but there must be like, just a rhythm and a lead. Yeah.
I think overall it kind of works as a Halloween record. You know, it has those themes, and it's kind of wild and creepy, and I think it works.
All right. Well, let's hear one of those creepy Halloween songs. This is Zombie Dance.
I hear the Fred Schneider there. Is that his name?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely the B-52s vibe.
A little more dancey, more upbeat.
So Zombie Dance was pretty much I picked because it has zombie in the title and it ties in with the Halloween thing. But I mean, that to me, what I was picturing was like, if you've seen the show Happy Days, if there was some twisted horror version of that, this is what would be being played at Al's Diner, you know?
Yeah. That sounds about right.
Yeah, so it's a playful take on that 50s and 60s sort of sock hop sound. But again, the subject matter is goofy and there's this sort of ugliness about it too, like that good kind of ugliness that comes, like we were talking about earlier, that comes from some of the New York City punk and post-punk bands. I love Poison Ivy's guitar work on that one. It adds to a supernatural vibe. It's just such a, like, it's like surf rock, but she's slapping the strings at the same time. It's, I don't know, it's really interesting. My clickbait headline to describe the album: Songs the Lord Taught Us, where psychobilly and surf rock collide in a monster-filled punk rebellion. That surf rock stuff, dude. I mean, mixed with that rockabilly punk sound that they invented a genre or subgenre, basically, with what they were doing. I mean, around the same time, there were bands like the Stray Cats taking that rockabilly, Elvis-y kind of vibe and trying to mix it with a punk rock aesthetic, but it was much more sanitized and cuter than this. And this is a lot more fun than I thought it would be. I've kind of avoided it over the years because it looked kind of gimmicky to me, but it totally is not when I actually listen to it.
Yeah. I associate them with like bands like the Misfits and stuff like that, but they're more shock and kind of
right
branding and stuff, I guess. But they're really not so much in that vein. And I feel like these songs do have some weight to them.
I agree. Like, and again, it's definitely a fun listen for a Halloween party. A lot of these songs would work.
Yeah, and it's a pretty quick listen overall. So yeah, if you have not heard Songs the Lord Taught Us, I think it's a good selection for your Halloween activities.
Before we continue on this spooky journey, why don't we hear from our friends over at the Polyphonic Press podcast.
Do you love music? Do you want to explore classic albums? If you answered yes, then check out Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy, and along with my co-host John, we rely on the patented random album generator to pick an album for us to review. At the top of each show, we have no idea what album we're going to be listening to. That's what keeps it really exciting. We dig real deep into these albums. So if this sounds interesting, come along with us on this journey, because you never know what you might find. We release a new episode every Tuesday morning. That's Polyphonic Press, and we're available on every podcast platform.
I'll have to check out the press there. It sounds pretty cool.
All right. Well, my pick for a Halloween record is Duran Duran's Dance Macabre, released in October of 2023. This is an interesting one. Technically, it's their 16th studio album by the band, formed in Birmingham in 1978. The band currently includes four members: singer Simon Le Bon, keyboardist Nick Rhodes, bass guitarist John Taylor, and drummer Roger Taylor. But this album also features guitar work from former members Andy Taylor and Warren Cucurullo. The origins of this are they performed a Halloween show in Las Vegas in 2022, and I guess they enjoyed that experience, so they decided to make or record a soundtrack to the ultimate Halloween party.
Nice. Now, you said they're from Birmingham. Now, I have a British friend who, last time you talked about Duran Duran and said Birmingham, he took issue with your
Birmingham
pronunciation.
How are you supposed to pronounce?
I think it's something like the Birmingham.
Birmingham.
I don't know.
Birmingham. Yeah, that's probably.
I don't know. That might be worse.
Sounds the same to me.
So the album features a mixture of new original material, covers, and reworkings of old songs. But here's the title track, Dance Macabre.
Y'all can't see it, but it's a rare sighting of Don actually dancing and grooving there on the camera. He can't help it. When Duran Duran's playing, he's got to move.
So Dance Macabre is a French term that translates to Dance of Death. So in art, it's often depicted as a procession of dance featuring both living and dead people. Yeah, so that, you know, that song, it kind of captures the spirit of the whole album, kind of dance-oriented, sort of those, like, ghostly synths, mm-hmm. some weird kind of haunting harmonies, like a creepy party vibe.
These are all sounds that Duran Duran has had throughout their discography, but they haven't been central to the songs. It's been more part of the vibe, so I like hearing that brought to the front. They're good at it.
Yeah.
I just don't think they knew they were.
Yeah. And it turns out Simon Le Bon can rap.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. We should have had him on the hip hop episode, right? Because
he didn't do that. And I'm here to say
he was just about to.
My name is Simon, and I'm here to say.
So, you know, while the song and the album itself kind of embraces Halloween themes, it's so with like a sense of humor, you know, so it's not truly scary or, again, just sort of a fun, goofy Halloween party. My clickbait headline for Dance Macabre is Duran Duran, take horrifying idea and make it work. So, you know, if somebody said, hey, Duran Duran's got a new album coming out, I'd be like, yeah. And they're like, well, it's, you know, it's Halloween themed. Like, okay. And then, right. You know, lots of cover songs. I'm like, yuck, you know, because I'm just not a huge fan of cover albums in general. And then I just hate it when artists re-record their old songs. It's
depends.
It's not for me usually.
Sometimes they get better at it though, man. You know, you play a song for years and years and you rearrange it and it, you know, it can happen.
Yeah.
Work. It doesn't often, but it can.
Yeah. And somehow, you know, this album works. And I don't know if it's just because it doesn't take itself too seriously. You know, it kind of is what it is. It's fun. Yeah, it's, I actually enjoy it. So, and actually this month, of this year, they've actually released a deluxe edition, which includes a new instrumental track that marks the beginning of the record called Mask of the Pink Death. They add a cover of ELO's Evil Woman, and then a reworking of this song, New Moon on Monday, now titled New Moon Dark Fade.
Yeah, Don once again is all animated. I picture 12-year-old version with a brush singing into a mirror right now. I like that version better than the original because it's less dated. The keyboards on the original are so early 80s, and I've always liked that song, but I really like this sort of darker version of it. It just works really well. I was actually, when I first heard it, I was like, no way. They really redid a song that I like better this way. So
you can also hear the words more, like the lyrics of
of
the verses. I still don't know what the song's about, but at least I know what the words are.
Yeah. It's about a new moon on Monday. I think it's starting fresh. That's kind of my take on it. But, you know, it also is good for the Halloween vibes where you think of the moon and dark sky and all that stuff. So it works really well on this record. It was a good choice. My clickbait headline to describe Dance Macabre: masterfully blended old and new with catchy covers for a genuine return to form that sounds classically Duran and a little spooky. I think this sounds more like them than a lot of their more recent records. They have moments on them that I enjoy, but this just sounds like they're having fun. It's not in reaction to sounds that are happening now. It's just, let's do a project and have fun. And you can hear it. And I really enjoy that. I miss that in bands. When they're around a long time and it becomes a machine to a certain extent, I think sometimes the fun isn't as palpable, and it is here.
Yeah. So I think sometimes they're guilty of trying too hard, you know, trying too hard to get the hit or trying too hard to capture a certain sound or something. And this one just seems like it came out naturally.
Simon sounds great too. If you told me that this was the original version of the song, I would believe you because he just sounds really good.
They do sound amazingly fresh, I would say. I couldn't really distinguish between the 80s material and the stuff like 40 years later, which is kind of amazing.
All right. Well, as I said, you know, this album features several covers, and here's one, Spellbound.
What's the name of the song again?
I'm not sure. New Mood on Monday or something? I don't know. a fun kind of like synthy version of the Susan and the Banshees song from back in that same era. Yeah, I enjoyed that cover. There's quite a few covers on the record. You got like Paint It Black, Psycho Killer, Evil Woman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Don't forget Billie Eilish.
What?
Is she Billie
Eilish, Bury a Friend.
Oh, huh? Wow. All right, my clickbait headline for Dance Macabre is Duran Duran are still dancing, but the macabre is starting to smell.
Uh-oh.
I don't know. I mean, I did enjoy this album. To me, it feels very much like a live concert feel. Like, I think maybe this is if I was at that show in Las Vegas a couple of years ago, maybe it was kind of in this vibe. I enjoy it. I mean, it's super dancey. It kind of feels like you're at a club at times, especially with the dark vibe on many of these tracks. I think that works, but I think, you know, largely, if you're a fan of the band, I think you probably would enjoy this, but it's more of a outsider looking in. I feel like this was kind of hit or miss, generally. I did enjoy a few of the tracks, especially the, I guess, is it the single, Black Moonlight there, towards the beginning of the record? Really fun, dancey track, good bass line.
Features Nile Rodgers on guitar.
Mm. Oh, nice. Should have guessed. But yeah, the middle third, I guess I kind of, whatever, but the ending with the covers and stuff is pretty fun. The opening of the record has this really cool instrumental, The Mask of the Pink Death, which is like just a Halloween vibe. They get going really strong there. I kind of wish I had more elements of that sprinkled throughout, a little bit more of that creepiness, a little less of the fun danciness, I guess. But, you know, it's Duran Duran, so I guess you want that.
But, yeah, I think also not just Duran Duran fans, but people who maybe grew up in the 80s and appreciate that sound might enjoy this record for Halloween as well. Just because it does capture some fun and does have some of those nice comfy 80s throwback vibes as well here and there. So
yeah, and they still really sound like themselves, which is amazing. I don't know what kind of health regimen
they're deal
own.
With the devil they made.
Yeah, seriously, it's working. Keep it up.
Yeah, so some other tracks that they redo from their catalog, Nightboat, which appeared on the first album. Kind of slowed down. I prefer the original version, but I mean, this version works. They go deep. They do Secret October 31st, which is a reworking of Secret October, which was a B-side to Union of the Snake. That one's pretty interesting.
Yeah, here comes the Duran Duran fan. Right.
Maybe the strangest one is they take Lonely in Your Nightmare from Rio, and they go right into Super Freak by Rick James.
That was an interesting
throws
choice.
Me off every time.
Yeah.
It's like, what? What just happened?
So that's now called Super Lonely Freak.
Okay.
But anyway, so it's not a classic Duran Duran album, but I think it does provide a nice soundtrack for a Halloween party. So it's Duran Duran Dance Macabre.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
And now it's time for a deep question by Don.
Whoa. Oh, are you coughing or was that an evil
laugh? That's supposed to be an evil laugh.
Come on.
I'll work on that.
Kick a moo-ha-ha-ha. That's better.
That's good.
Okay, so tell us about a Halloween costume from your past that stands out in your memory.
Well, Andy dresses up for Halloween every year, so he doesn't have to go too far back.
Yeah, I do kind of love dressing up for Halloween. I thought a lot of characters. One that I remember from my childhood that I mentioned, what I thought was kind of cool. Growing up, you know, we made all of our costumes, like, from whatever was around the house. And one year, I wanted to be a dump truck, so my dad made me a little...
Wait, back up. Boop, boop, boop.
Yeah.
You wanted to be a dump truck. I think we need to explore this, give some reasons.
Well, you know, like a young kid, I was in the construction vehicles, you know, dump trucks and backhoes and diggers, etc. Anyway, so I was a dump truck, and the cool thing was that when I go up to the house and ask for, you know, trick or treat, I would have to turn around and pull a little string, and my butt would lift up, and they could put the candy in directly into my caboose, sort of.
Wow.
So that was cool. I like that.
That is cool.
That's a good way to protect your candy stash from any siblings. If it's butt candy, they aren't going to want to steal any of yours.
Yeah, that's true. Much safer than a pillowcase. But yeah, I've had some good costumes in my adult life as well. I've been Jerry Garcia, but probably my favorite one is the dude. Dude. I was from Big Lebowski a couple times.
I like your style, yeah, dude.
Yeah, he did the Lebowski. Now, if you wanted to do it right, shave your head, get some cool glasses,
right?
Grow a couple feet, and then you could be me.
Yeah, at least a couple feet. Yeah. Do you have any good costumes, man?
Not really. I mean, I only did Halloween till I was like 12, but one of my favorites was a Superman costume. This is when you'd get these plastic, it was like you'd buy it, but it was basically a garbage bag with
Just like printed on it, right? Like,
yeah, printed on it. And then just this mask that was a plastic mask just on the front, right? Like for the trick-or-treating, it was fine, right? I liked being Superman. But what I would do at home with the mask is I would put on like my church suit and then put the mask, the Superman mask on, put my glasses on over it and be Clark Kent.
That's great.
Yeah. So, I mean, I wore that for like 2 or 3 years till I popped holes in it. But one of the best Halloween things that ever happened, I was probably wearing that costume and my mom was taking us trick-or-treating and we got to this house that had like spooky music and lights and stuff on their porch. And there was like this dummy sitting in a rocking chair, looked kind of like a creepy clown or something. Mm-hmm. So we're getting our candy and stuff. My mom's fascinated with this thing. She's poking it and then she poked its eye and the guy jumps up, and screams at her and she went shrieking away from the house. So.
It's like, I was trying to scare the kids, but I guess I'll make an exception if you're poking my eye.
Yeah, but the guy got his eye poked. She put her finger in his eye.
It's a good test.
What about you, Don?
Well, according to like my old family photo albums, I think my first Halloween costumes, I think 2 years in a row, I was the Jolly Green Giant. Like,
really?
Wow, corporate.
Yeah, I know. Blame my mom.
Eat your vegetables, kids. Wow.
Yeah.
People are trying to give you Del Monte vegetables in your bag. You're like, no, Green Giant.
And then, I was still quite young, but maybe today it would be a controversial choice, but I was a black ghost.
Okay.
Instead of a white sheet, it was a black sheet. And for some reason, I wanted to be a black ghost. Like, I don't think it had any real racial implications.
Yeah. Probably sure just started to be more, it'd be creepy.
Probably very hard to see you at night out there in the trick-or-treating. Did you have to wear like reflectors or something? Or?
I think I used to go trick-or-treating with my sister, so I was next to her. I think she was Uncle Sam that year.
These choices, like, I think really as people grow up and they seek any kind of therapy in their lives, that's one of the things that the psychotherapist should ask, like, what costumes did you choose as a child? Because I think that could really open some doors to figuring out who a person
is. There's a lot about you. I mean, Don in the black sheet, I mean, that's pretty on the nose.
Yep. He was already into the gothic stuff. Gothic ghost maybe would be a better description there in the future.
Yeah. It was also later, I think in middle school, I was a California raisin. Anyway, what Halloween costumes do you remember? Let us know. Hit us up on the socials, Instagram and Facebook, or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
So I struggled with this one a little bit. I was really close on that Iced Earth album, but I ended up going with Typo Negative and their 1993 album, Bloody Kisses. Typo Negative was an American gothic doom metal band formed in Brooklyn, New York in 1989 by Peter Steele. He was bass and lead vocals, Kenny Hickey on guitar and co-lead vocals, Josh Silver on keyboards and backing vocals, and Sal Abruscato on drums and percussion, and John Kelly later replaced him. The music was heavily centered on themes of romance, depression, and death, which led to their nickname, the Drab Four, which instead of the Fab Four.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, Pete Steele passed away in 2010 at the age of 48. So Bloody Kiss is their third studio album. It's a breakthrough for them. It's satirical lyrics, a blend of gothic metal, doom, and dark humor paved the way for this sound. And it's the first album from Roadrunner Records to be certified gold and later platinum.
Nice.
Yeah, I know. We Roadrunner's been coming up a lot lately. Why don't we check out a little bit of Black Number One, Little Miss Scare-All?
Is it like a mascara play, sort of, or what is it?
Miss Scare-All instead of Miss Clare-All, which was a thing in the 70s and 80s.
Is that like a makeup brand?
Or it's like a hair color thing.
Oh, okay.
Because she dyes her hair black. Black Number One is the hair dye. All right, let's listen.
Well, will she trick or treat? I bet she will.
Probably the best known track from the album, sarcastic ode to goth culture, specifically addressing a girlfriend who dyed her hair black to match her goth aesthetic. It's a perfect example of the band's doom pop style. Catchy chorus, dark sludgy guitars, and then the signature vocal style of Pete Steele and those Dracula rolled R's and those hard hit K's when he's milk white neck. Very Dracula-y.
Yeah. He is up on that microphone, man. I love it.
Yeah. So there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek references to Halloween, Nosferatu, Lily Munster. Adam's Family theme appears briefly in the song. So yeah, they were, what I didn't understand at the time was that they were having fun with this and poking fun at themselves and at the darkness that they were representing. And I kind of dismissed it as, well, not grunge, so I wasn't interested. I did see them open for Pantera in like early 95, and I kind of started to change my mind because they were really good. They sounded really good live, so.
Wow.
Well, Pete Steele didn't want to go on the road because he liked being working for the Parks Department in New York and picking up garbage. He enjoyed it, apparently. This 6'8" dude with hair down to his ass looks like Dracula, and he's picking up garbage. But
can you imagine like throwing your wrappers down? Or like you-
just gives you a look.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Why don't you pick that up? But I guess they got their Motley Crue offered them an opening spot on their tour, and that's what helped break them.
Cool.
So my clickbait headline to describe the album, Typo Negative's Bloody Kisses, the album that made goth metal sexy and scary. It did make it sort of sensual, more so than I think some others. It was more about the scare and less about, and that gothic romance thing, you know, that whole, because those old Dracula movies always had him as being kind of a ladies' man,
right.
I think.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
totally. That's reflected here on many of the songs. But also at the base of it, Pete Steele was self-conscious, and a lot of this bravado was a way of making fun of himself, which has been interesting getting to understand that as I've dug into this. Why don't we hear a little bit of the title track, Bloody Kisses.
The almost 11-minute long title cut there.
Yeah, they stretch them out, don't they?
There's a couple on this album that they do get a little comfortable in, I would say. My clickbait headline for Bloody Kisses is Typo Negative brings the weird, but left me wondering if their kisses are bloody or if they're just messy with the ketchup. I enjoy this record. I find it very interesting. There's a lot going on. I mean, it's a long record and some of the tracks are a little uneven, but it's interesting. I give them credit for trying some new stuff. Where I get caught up on is some tracks are clearly a joke. Like there's a song, Kill All the White People, or We Hate Everyone. I really enjoyed those two songs. I thought they were pretty good. But they're definitely taking some shots at, you know, the goth audience and, you know, what goes into that. But then there's tracks that seem very serious and dark just on their own. And I wasn't really sure, like, are we supposed to be taking all this seriously? Or are things like that title cut there seems very gravely serious to me, and I guess I was just confused if I was misunderstanding some of the lyrics.
I think the intention was just creating good songs. I think because of the sound of the album, you can kind of ignore that it's tongue-in-cheek and being funny if you so choose, and sink into the darkness, or you can use those more moments of levity to pull yourself out of the darkness of those other songs. But so I get what you're saying. It can be a little confusing if you're really paying attention to the lyrics.
Yeah, well, besides those mixed messages, I think it does feel like an exciting album. I appreciate it as kind of like that goth rock style. And Steele's voice is awesome. Like, I really thought he was two or three vocalists in the band. I didn't realize it was all one guy.
Well, you know, there are moments where you can tell that it's Kenny Hickey.
Okay.
But yeah, the majority is Pete Steele. All right, so why don't we move on to a song that I definitely, you know, you could take one way or the other. Let's listen to a little bit of Christian Woman.
Born lost, she'll burn in hell, a soul on.
So Christian Woman depicts a woman's struggle between religious devotion and sexual desire, supposedly inspired by a woman, you know, Steele was romantically involved with. You know, she supposedly wanted him to dress up as a priest during sex.
Sure. happens to everyone, right?
So the song actually has three distinct parts. They're actually identified. So the first part is Body of Christ or Corpus Christi.
Corpus Christi. And then second part is to love God, which I think is that kind of acoustic-y part that's really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden it's Jesus Christ looks like me.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it is weird, yeah. Man.
So it's like a medley. It's a bouillabaisse.
It is a bouillabaisse. Nice. Yeah,
there you go. Bring that back.
In total, it's about 9 minutes long, the song. But I think because it is split up into three parts, it kind of works. I think my favorite part about this song in particular is just those atmospheric keyboards, you know, that really make it dramatic. Reminds me of the Sisters of Mercy.
Yeah.
This track really in general sounds like a Sisters of Mercy track.
Yeah.
Well, it all sounds like, you know, Gothic cathedral stuff, which I think is why those touches are in there. But yeah, Pete Steele's just an interesting character. I mean, I briefly met him at a in-store signing thing at a record store back in the 90s. He was huge. And then he would call the record store I worked at because he was trying to date my manager, Gina, because he had met her at that same thing. So I've always felt this kind of familiarity with him because he just seemed like a normal dude when I met him. And then listening to this music the character is at the forefront,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
What if he was calling from the payphone at the state park?
Maybe.
So my clickbait headline for Bloody Kisses is typo negatives. Bloody Kisses is a positive experience. The blood type.
A blood positive joke. Nice.
There you go. So yeah, I enjoy this record a lot. I mean, it's a bit long overall, and it's messy. You know, I wonder if it would have benefited from a tighter treatment, maybe more focus. But you know, it's kind of hard to say. You know, like would the Beatles' White Album have been better if they cut out some of that stuff? It's kind of part of the identity of this album.
Yeah, I think that the way it is probably the right way, because if those songs weren't so expansive, you wouldn't have the same impression of this band. And what the impression of this band and this album is that this is this flight of fancy, this dark trip through romance and life and self-identity and all that stuff. So I actually let myself sink into those moments instead of fighting.
You kind of have to like give yourself over to this record to some degree.
Yeah, just like you give yourself over to Dracula when he hypnotizes you with his eyes.
Exactly. Just open your neck up for him. Yeah. Here you go.
Yeah, so it's, I think like Andy, I sometimes struggle whether to take it seriously or not, you know, but I guess that's part of its charm, sort of the ambiguity of it.
Yeah, a fun little tidbit of information I came across was, again, leaning into this fun aspect of the band, the album features additional vocal performances from close friends of the band, including Mina Caputo, Joey Zampella, and Alan Robert of Life of Agony, a band that was also on their label. And they were credited as the Erasmus High School Boys Special Ed in the album liner notes. And there was also some singers credited as the Benson Hoist Lesbian Choir. So I don't know what that was about exactly, but they just had this sense of humor amid this darkness that they were representing.
Yeah, you could go too dark, right? If you went,
yeah,
full goth, yeah.
Never go full goth.
right, yeah. Well said.
And of course, Summer Breeze, the cover of the Seals and Crofts song, is on this record, and they do a really good job of creeping that up. I guess originally they rewrote the lyrics and called it Summer Girl. You can find it on the web if you want to hear it, but they Seals and Crofts shot it down because they thought that the lyrics were too gross. So go find that if you're interested. Yeah, Typo Negative's Bloody Kisses blends this brooding atmosphere, dark humor, eerie sound, and evokes this feeling of walking through a haunted cemetery at night sometimes. So it's a perfect addition to a Halloween playlist, so go check it out if you haven't heard it before.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Well, I guess this week we were kind of, digging in the cemetery or digging graves.
Digging graves. There you go.
Yeah. Find some good stuff.
Did you dig anything else?
Yeah, I got a few things here in my trick-or-treat bag.
Okay, good. You went where I thought you were going to go.
Not your dump truck.
Or your plastic pumpkin.
All the above. First one I'll mention here is from singer-songwriter of Portishead fame.
Oh.
I guess it's technically her first solo album. It's called Lives Outgrown. That came out earlier this year. Let's play Floating on a Moment.
Definitely some floating. going on there in that sound. I like it.
Mm-hmm. It's a very ethereal record. Not dark, I wouldn't say. Maybe not a good Halloween choice, but if you want a little uplift after the Halloween.
Maybe on All Saints Day, the next day.
The other one I want to mention here is something that has intrigued me. It's kind of a more recent development in music where artists will release an album and then release it again, like an edited version of it, a couple months later. So Charlie XTC, who put out an album earlier this year called Brat, it's been very well received by the critics, very popular with the kids. She released a totally new version of it called Brat, and it's completely different, but also still Brat, just about a week ago. It's got a whole bunch of new tracks, some reworking of old tracks. We're going to play a cut here. I think this has Billie Eilish on it. It's called Guess.
Yikes.
Goodness.
Pretty explicit. Yeah. But interesting. Have you guys come across this one of your artists that you follow where they'll re-release something right after releasing it?
Not right after so much. A lot of the things I follow are older bands who re-release, they'll remake whole albums or whatever. I think because of streaming rights and copyright and stuff, I think they redo their songs so that the streaming rights to it, you know.
Kind of approach.
I think there was a Shins record recently where they re-released it a second time, and all of a sudden the quiet songs were loud and the louder songs were quiet. So it was the same songs but completely redone. Yeah.
Interesting.
There's that Peter Gabriel record a couple of years ago that was released two versions on the same day that I could barely tell the difference between.
But. That's right. Yeah, I forgot about that one. Yeah, there's something cool about the streaming platform that allows for this kind of editing in real time, sort of.
Yeah.
What you been digging on, Don?
There's a band from Rochester, New York, formed in 1978 called the Chesterfield Kings. And so they've got a brand new album coming out called We're Still All the Same. Just kind of like I think they came out in the 70s and they were already retro at the time. They were kind of doing like 60s garage music. Yeah. So here's a track called What's the Value of Time? Opening cut. Yeah, they have a long history. They actually appear in an episode of The Sopranos performing at Adriana's club. So
awesome.
Check that out. And then Dwight Yoakam is back and better than ever. His new album comes out November 15th called Brighter Days. It's his first album since 2016. Here's a single called Wide Open Heart. She's got a wide
open heart. Oh, I thought it was going to be about having open heart surgery since he's a little older now.
I love him in Sling Blade.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I forgot he did a little acting.
But there's another song that features Post Malone.
Man, that guy is just everywhere.
I'm curious what that... I mean, I don't really want to know, but I kind of want to know what that sounds like. He's doing more country lately, right?
Oh, Post Malone. Yep. Dude.
So you guys made efforts to escape the Halloween, and I just kept going.
Dove right in.
Yeah. So in my travels through Halloween Town, I ran into Unto Others, which we've talked about on the show before, this band from Oregon, I believe. Their new album, just released in September, is called Neverland. It's their third.
Neverland.
And it showcases the band's growth as they blend this gothic rock sound with heavy metal elements. So why don't we check out a little bit of Butterfly? Come, my lady. Come, my lady. No, not that. Thank God.
Wow, things I thought I'd never hear you say.
No offense to Shifty Shell Shock. Rest in peace.
Wow. That was impressive, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely in that same vein.
Mm-hmm.
I think we talked about these guys on that same episode that we did The Cure Pornography.
I think you're right. Yeah, I really like their sound. I think they're carrying this on very well, and they have continued through each album to add some additional metal elements to kind of spice things up. So you should definitely check that one out. And then, as always, I like to bring up something I have in my record collection. I picked this up several years ago, but it's just a must-have, I think, in any record collector's shelves if you like heavy metal. So it's Iron Maiden, The Number of the Beast, released in 1982. It's kind of defined heavy metal as we know it with their intricate guitar work. So why don't we check out a little bit of the title track, The Number of the Beast.
Yeah,
Man, when I was a little kid, I was pretty young, but this scared everybody's parents. All my, you know, my friends had older teenage siblings.
Satanic panic going on, man.
Yeah. I was not allowed to listen to Iron Maiden.
Nice.
Or play Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah. Probably shouldn't have been. Who knows how weird you'd be now. So, that's, you know, classic, and it's good Halloween stuff with a little bit of, you know, your devils and monsters and whatnot, so.
All right, well, what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show. I'm reminded of the great British writer and physician, Sir Arthur Ignatius Conan Doyle, the guy who wrote Sherlock Holmes, I believe. He said, "Where there is no imagination, there is no horror." Mm. With that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, Wadbot, and see what we'll be discovering on next week's episode.
It's time to explore the roots of much of the popular music we know today. Next time, you'll experience some of the best albums that the blues has to offer as we take a deep dive into the genre's most influential records.
Dun, 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 it's the Album Nerds Podcast. Dun, 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 just three guys that love tunes. Dun, 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 dun. Next week, we'll treat you to a little bit of blues. Yeah.
Sound like George Thorogood.
I'm not a blues man. Next week. But it looks like we're going to experience some true blues masters. Yeah, so that should be fine. A little change of pace.
Yeah, totally different, as we always do.
All right, well, what's your favorite blues album? What else are you listening to? Leave a comment on our website or email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. Also, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Album Nerds. And please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so via PayPal at albumnerds.com/support.
Thank you once again for joining us here on the Album Nerds Podcast. Have a spooky Halloween, and then get depressed and listen to the blues when it's all over.
Coming down from that sugar rush. Thanks for listening, everybody. Catch you next week.
I was working in the lab late one night.
I don't know the rest. Remember the Monster Mac from McDonald's?
I do. Three patties on that bad boy.
Whoa.
I remember eating those the fall it came out. I had two for lunch.
Not to go to the ghost of heartburn ever since.
Ah, the children of the night never drink wine.